ethnography with activity theory. So this lecture will introduce the practice of applying ethnography for design intentions, basically to start to research before you start designing something. And activity theory is basically the framework that we use to analyze the data you collect, the observations, and how you also devise your change strategy. How do you plan your project to contribute for changing the activities that you are studying? Ethnography is a 23rd century technique developed by Malinowski. He is a pioneer of ethnography, and he did his first study with the Trobians. It's kind of a native tribe in Oceania. And he said that ethnography was the study of a culture through the eyes or through the point of view of the natives. And the goal was to stay together with these people long enough for you to develop an insider perspective. So you could understand why do they do things the way they do through their own explanations. Instead of you judging, oh, these people look primitive and there's nothing interesting to study on them, you depart from the assumption that yes, they do have something. In fact, they do have something interesting to study. They have a different way of living, which might give us some understanding about the human nature and the human condition. That's why ethnography is a major technique used, or major method used, in anthropology, which is the study of humans in society. And there are some, I just choose some six key concepts. It might be difficult for you to understand if you don't have an anthropology background. You don't need to understand this to understand the rest of the lecture. I would just mention them. If you are curious about it, you can go and research and search for them on Google and see what they say. But I want to mention, because I don't want to explain design ethnography the usual way people do, as a mere technique or method to inquire about user needs. I just want to show that there is a tradition of much broader and deep way of doing ethnography, which is sometimes forgotten and not even mentioned by design ethnographers. So here are the six elements that I find quite interesting in anthropology. They start from the beginning that you should avoid ethnocentrism, which is judging one culture from another culture perspective. So if you see something that it looks wrong to you, for example, Brazilian indigenous people, if they have a child which is handicapped, they sometimes kill the child. And from your cultural perspective, this seems to be wrong. But from their cultural perspective, this is reasonable because they do not have social security to take care of this kind of children. And then some people would say, yeah, but the human rights, everybody should have access to human rights. This is universal. Universal by whom? Who proclaimed the human rights? Those were not the indigenous people. They were not part of it. They came from a specific culture in the world. Hence, in anthropology, you do not judge if an indigenous person kills a baby. You try to understand why, from their perspective. And the second corollary notion is appreciation for different people and recognizing that the other is different from yourself. It's kind of a bit even a spiritual idea, like I love other people and I appreciate that they are different from me, and I do not try to say that I have the whole world inside myself and it's enough. No, there's a lot of different things to learn from other people. Then estrangement comes from the late 20th century anthropology. Once they start to do ethnography in their everyday lives in their own countries, in the beginning ethnography was about other cultures. Now it's becoming more common ethnography about our own culture. And to study your own culture, you need to be aware that you are part of it, and you cannot study without distantiating yourself from the culture and looking at things as if they were very weird. And that's what estrangement means. So, in Portuguese, estranhamento. Você estranha uma situação normal. Once you do ethnography, you represent other people, and there are a lot of implications. For example, if you describe people as primitive, as not having a soul, then it might justify slavery and other weird things. This is a kind of radical example, but if you look at ethnographies of gendered people, different sexual orientation, some people might make big mistakes and represent these people in a different way that they wouldn't like to be represented. Point of view, I already explained, you should strive for taking into account many different perspectives. And bias, this is the thing that some ethnographers believe that you cannot avoid having a bias, and others would say you should avoid having a bias. What is a bias? You see reality the way you like to see. You don't see other things because you would like reality to be in your own way. And you might not even be aware that you are framing reality in that way. Alright, that's all about ethnography I want to tell you. I just want to go to the practice right away. So ethnography moved from the exotic to the familiar. And here you can see Helene Jakub. She's a commercial ethnography, so to speak. She works for major companies in Rio, reporting what are the consuming habits of inhabitants of Rio de Janeiro favelas. And she has, of course, clients who sell services and products to the C class, so-called D and E class of our economic marketing system. This is my, like, known as marketing anthropology or marketing ethnography, but this is design ethnography. One guy who is really well known for doing design ethnography in the open, so he was telling everybody what he was doing, it's called Yonchip Chase. He worked for Nokia for 8 years or so. Today he has his own consultancy, and he traveled around the whole world and trying to understand how different people use phones. What are the different adaptations people do, how do they make a living out of phone negotiations and phone transactions. So basic design ethnography aims to uncover needs and find new opportunities for company development and product development, service development, so on. And how do they do that? They observe the reality, they observe the situation, how people use current technology, how people use services. And then they try to generate insights from invention, from translation, acceleration, deceleration, expansion, contraction. There are many different techniques you can use to understand that situation. For example, if you see a person using a cell phone in a certain way, you never thought that this could be done, then you try to make a service that emphasizes or stimulates people to use in that way. For example, Nokia discovered that phone rental stores in Africa, there were phone rental stores, I don't know nowadays, but this was is already a 10 years old study, but people couldn't afford to have their own phone, and then they would go to a booth, a commercial booth, a very small enterprise, and the guy would rent the phone for a call or something like that. They didn't have a traditional line phone structure that we do have in Brazil. That's all they had at that time. And since the phone were shared with multiple people, they had a collective address book. If you wanted to keep track of your phone numbers, you could put a collective phone book. It's kind of a collaborative yellow pages. Well, Nokia observed this and they just created a function in the phone. So this model could have multiple address books, and you can switch through one or the other address book, and it was a phone targeted at these developing marketers. They would never have this idea if they haven't observed the practice, all right? Motorola also tried to invest in ethnographic research before they had this big crisis and were bought by Google, I believe. Well, they were doing some studies and they discovered that in India, if you didn't have a very loud ringtone, people would not listen to their phones while joining wedding parties. And these wedding parties in India, they can take a long, very long, something around 10 days even. People would not use their phones at all. So they created that phone, especially for the world. And it's also a phone for the illiterate people, that people that could not read, they still could use the phone because they had all kinds of icons, kind of as visual language. In Brazil, this was quite well sold, I believe. Have you ever seen this phone model?
Mm-hmm.
Who?
My mom.
Your mom had it.
It was pretty good because she's not good with technology.
Right.
And
it came all from this ethnographic research. All the functions. For example,
the numbers are pretty big.
Pretty big. And also, if you put under the sun, you can still read the numbers.
I didn't know that. I don't remember.
And they did for especially for the African people, because they have a lot of sun over there. So how design ethnography works? It's kind of messy. You may start from any of these points, all right, and then you might go from any of these points to the other. And it has no 1, 2, 3, 4 step by step approach, because design ethnography is all about discovering things that you don't know before you go. And if you know the steps, then you might know the answers. So it's no point of actually doing design ethnography if you think that you know too much. You only do design ethnography if you depart from the assumption that you want to discover something new and you are open for that. So you have questions, you have hypotheses, interests about your users and your people that the culture you are studying. And then you do observations, interviews, workshops. You might raise new questions, new interests, new hypotheses. Then you might generate from that directly have insights, needs, ideas, concepts, things that can start up a project. But then you go back to the hypothesis, interests, questions. Then you interpret those insights, the needs. And then you find out that, oh, this was not exactly a real need. It's just something that I think they need. And then you revise it. And then you share with other people and you maybe even co-create insights and ideas with users, with the culture, the native, so to speak. So this is basically the abstract representation of what ethnography work is about. It's difficult to understand from that perspective. That's why I have some pictures of the actual work being done. So these are some design ethnographies that I conducted myself. Here I was studying how a seller sells or customizes. What's the name of that stuff? Well, it's the stuff that covers the window from the outside. You know what I'm talking about? Toldo in Portuguese. I don't know the name. Shades, I believe in English. Shades. So they are customizing shades and they have a very, very difficult process of finding out which kind of shades the client would need. And I studied and I showed to the client, look, the way you are specifying and customizing it takes so long and the customer do not understand what's going on, and after it's installed, the customer might be unhappy. It's often unhappy that you have to start again. So you need better visualization tools, like 3D visualization of the shades on the window. Here I'm studying people designing a hospital, and look, I'm recording it, so I'm recording myself recording, which is a way of looking at how do I record? Why do I record this specific action and not what's going on this part of the scene? Here is the actual recorded video. The video that is here is now here, and I'm analyzing everything that people say, tagging, and looking very carefully at each gesture. And sometimes I do that only by
audio descriptions, I only record audio, and then here's a transcription of an interview, and I'm coding parts of the interview. It's called qualitative analysis. Here I'm looking at people in a park in Holland. For the entire day, I was just looking what people were doing there, because it was a design, urban planning project about redesigning this park, and I wanted to understand, first of all, how people use this park in the first place. Nobody even bothered about this. And I went there, then I brought back to the project, look, people are using this and that way. Why are you designing the park to stimulate people to do things that they are not doing there, they don't want to do that? And here, I was studying the impact of a high-speed train project in London, and we try to make sense out of the affected region. So yeah, there are other studies that I did that I didn't take a picture, so I cannot share now. But in a nutshell, design ethnography is all about observing, taking notes, trying to interpret what's going on, and generating insights from that. This is a visualization of all the notes that I took during my PhD track, which was a series of 6 ethnographic studies. So all the notes together, it's more than 3,000 notes. What is a note? I just write down what was happening, or I attach a picture or something like that. So it's a
how do you make connections?
What? How do I make connections?
Yeah, how all of them are connected.
With the system, the note
but
system.
Three colors.
No, wait. Just forget about the colors.
Mm-hmm.
The connections are made because I use a visual node system. It's kind of mind mapping. So once I make a node, I attach to another node through a visual link. And here I've exported all the data and then visualized in a different way than the software actually provides. So if you do note taking like I do, you just definitely need a way to organize the notes. And here is the explanation for the colors. First of all, I look at all that big picture and said, I need to organize this, and I try to classify which kind of notes I was making, and I use a theoretical framework that says that if you are having a note about theoretical insights, for example, trying to explain what's going on through a theory, I have theory historical notes. If I'm trying to explain what's going on from my perspective, not from theory, it's object historical notes. If I'm just describing what happened and not trying to explain or interpret, then it's actually empirical notes. And this is a timeline. This is the beginning of my PhD, and that is basically the end. So you can see that at the beginning, a lot more theory, theoretical notes, and empirical notes. It took me a long time to start really observing what people really do. Here was reading descriptions of what people do. Here was making my own assumptions about these readings. And here was starting to talk to people about the importance of actually looking at them. And you also see that there was no much connection between them at the beginning. But at some point in the middle, I was all the time looking at the literature, looking at the theory, and trying to devise my own explanations from the observations. And at the end, I also kept going the theoretical part, and it was not so much useful. I read a lot more than I needed for my research. I could have stopped here about that time to read the new theories. But alright, I can use them now for other means, for other purposes. So the role of theory in ethnography. Some researchers are against starting from the theories. They say, forget about theories, just go and look at what people do. But I prefer to start with theory because it leads to more focused observations, simpler data analysis, and knowledge co-creation. Why is knowledge co-creation? Because you do one study, and then you do a second study, and then you can compare them through theory. Because theory gives you a kind of a shared background, a shared minimum ground that you can use to compare what you have done in two different studies. There are limitations, of course. There's more bias. You may jump too soon into conclusions, and maybe you distort data. because you want to fit the framework you choose. So you really want to confirm that your theory is right. Yeah, that's that. There's other limitations, all right. So I know it. There are different theories for analyzing ethnographic data.
What?
You said something? All right. So there's activity theory, which is the focus here. Ethnographic theory, cognitive engineering. Cognitive engineering, by the way, leads to usability studies. Like, it's the region of usability tests and so on. I'm not using the same framework. Activity theory is basically a theory that was developed in Russia, very much inspired by Karl Marx, who says that my own existence is social activity. Even if I'm alone, I'm writing and using language that I learned through other people, through the social. And the basic concept of activity theory is mediation. Mediation means that everything I do is mediated by a sign. A sign is something that I develop myself internally, but I also learn from other people what it means. For example, if someone will bring me, so please bring me your, let me try this. Bring me your knee. May I use this suit?
Yep.
All right. All right. So if I do this, then what is the response?
Okay.
All right. How do you know?
Because of the lecture test.
Right. You have heard about this test, stimulus response, the doctor test, the reflex test, right? But I haven't hit you with the proper instrument and not in the proper place because I'm not a doctor. But still, you get the response because you do have this sign. You know the sign, right? You know that if the doctor do this, you should kick the doctor, right? So this is the sign we acquire socially. And if you don't know that, it's not going to work. All right, so the stimulus response theory is rejected by activity theory. This is bullshit. It doesn't exist in humans. It's always mediated by a sign. That's why the name of the concept is mediation. And these signs, they are socially constructed and also learned. For example, look at the way they explain how the baby learns to do a sign. For example, this sign, pointing. First of all, the baby is moving randomly. And then the baby is doing all kinds of random movements. You can really observe this, that babies do things that with no intentions. But as soon as the mother sees the baby doing this, and then there is a toy, then the mother brings the toy to the baby. And the baby is amused. Wow, I got a toy. What? Maybe if it was this movement that brought the toy. And then the baby tries again, and then now he can control. And then she brings the toys again. And then the baby learns the sign that if he points up to something, then this means I want that. So this sign was not learned by the baby because the baby is smart. It was learned because the baby has other people around him that knows this sign. And then he learned socially. If the baby was alone in the forest, he would never learn this sign. And maybe even die. Learning comes from engaging in an activity. That's one of the basic tenets also of activity theory. There's a brilliant, very beautiful documentary called Território do Brincar. Which was aired in the cinema last year. It's really, really beautiful way of showing how important is playing for kids. And how do they, for example, here they are learning cooking. So they are learning cooking by playing out their cooking, right? And you basically learn much more if you are playing with other kids than if you are playing alone. That's why kids like to hang around together. All right, let's go deep into the theory and see what are the elements. Activity theory has a longer name, a bigger name. To be specific, cultural historic activity theory, also called CHAT. And the guy who devised it is called Engstrom. Let's analyze an activity theory. So once you are observing that activity, you have got all the data, then you can apply this framework to understand what's going on. So you analyze the observations. And here I'm going to use the example of intensive care of premature babies. What are people transforming? What do you think that people are transforming in this example? In intensive care of babies. Remember that the notion of object, well, you were not here in the last lecture. The object is something that you want to transform in an activity. What are people trying to transform? The baby. The baby? They want to transform the whole baby? Hope?
The hope of the mother.
Well, maybe that's something that's kind of a result that they want. But not exactly the thing that they are changing. Because if they want
to...
The environment. The health. The baby's health is their object. So that the whole activity of baby intensive care is to take care of the baby's health. They really want to improve it, right? Or at least keep it okay. So the result that they expect is a healthy baby, all right? And what are the instruments? Well, there are a lot of them. There are baby warmer, inhaler, antibiotics, right? You see a very busy room because they use a lot of instruments to make sure that the object, the baby's health, is transforming into the result of healthy child and a happy mother too. Then it brings back to your idea of hope, right? I think that sometimes hope can even be an instrument. For example, a motivation that the mother uses to be there all the time, staying together with the child. So I would say that hope is more like an instrument. And people may even improve that instrument by bringing external motivation for keeping this hope alive. All right. This is the first level of analysis, right? You just look at the people, object, and instruments. But now it's going to get a bit more complicated once we start to look at all other people around. Once you start to think about community. So look at the baby. The baby's health is actually a sum of two parts. In one part, there is the material body of the baby, and another part is the representation of that material body. And basically, the way they do this activity is they separate those two things. Because we have such a high advanced instruments, we can represent the baby's health much better than if you would just look at the baby from the skin signs, or for example, the basic signs of body behavior. Through these representations, the object is expanded, and then you can understand this object much better than if you were not having those instruments. And sometimes the representations of the body are more important or more considered than actually the material body of the baby, because they become a proxy. Once you try to interfere with that body, you use the instruments. Look at this example. This child is really having a bad time, and they are pumping air using a repeated pattern. They must be very... they must synchronize this air pumping with a heart rate beat, which is shown here. Look at the nurse. They are not looking at the baby any longer. They are very much concerned about the baby's health. They are working really hard to keep the baby alive. However, they are using the representation instruments to interfere with that baby's health. So, once we talk about objects in activity theory, that means material plus representation part. How do these people form a community? So that's the next step in activity theory analyzing. Well, the baby care team, they form a very sensitive community. They are kind to mothers and the family. But they're not necessarily kind to the baby, because the baby is their object. It's not a subject any longer. So they do not treat the baby as if they were like a person. They treat the baby as an object that they're trying to transform. Right? They try to not get too attached to the babies, because sometimes babies die, unfortunately. And that can be very damaging if they have an emotional connection to the babies. They have emotional bonds to the mothers and family, because they are also responsible for somehow taking care of them in the case of fatality. But they are not so attached to the babies. So this is a characteristic of this community. How do they organize work? Well, then there are two different elements coming into place. One side you have rules that govern people in the community, and the division of labor that organize the community, how do they transform the object. And this is the whole model. I'm not going to go any more complex for that. Bom dia.
Tudo bom? Nossa, turma grande!
Ha.
Opa! Como é que pede? Desculpa se interromper.
Não, fica tranquilo.
É porque depois ela queria que eu possa conversar contigo sobre a intervenção para a Holanda.
Ah, muito legal. Tá bom. Conversamos então. É 11h55, terminal.
Tá, eu vou ficar aqui.
Termina meio-dia, né?
É, meio-dia. Tá bom? Se quiser ficar na aula, também pode ficar. Right, in English. Alright, so I'm not going to go any more complex than this level, although there are plenty of other complex things in activity theory, but for today's lecture we just go to this level. So here is an example of rules plus division of labor. The doctor devises a care plan for the baby, and the nurse must keep track of what they are doing, so they must execute the plan that the doctor devised, and they must also write down on papers what they are doing every time they do a dose or change something. But sometimes the nurses, they see an unexpected change in the condition of the baby's health. For example, the numbers are raising or lowering, and then they need to intervene in a way that was not predicted by the doctor. But the doctor is not there to tell the nurse what to do, and she must improvise. And things can go bad, very wrong, if the care plan is too strict and there are no room for flexibility. So this is the activity system model, as you have seen before. And this is the most important model you're going to learn to analyze ethnographic data in this course. This turns into simple questions you can ask once you start studying activity. What is the activity? Where does it take place? Who are the people carrying it on? What are they trying to transform? What is the expected result from transformation? What are the instruments used? How do people divide work? How do they control and regulate work? And how do they form a community? If you answer all those questions, you can have a simple ethnographic study. If you choose an activity, answer those questions by directly observing and not just speculating, because you can sit down on a chair and then, let's write down what I know about this activity. But you may not know all these answers, and you may know something that is wrong, which is not really true what's going on. So how to collect and organize evidence of activity? Data collection instruments you can use. Direct observation, so you use your body, so you go there, put your body there and see the activity going on. And you may see things that you think that you're seeing in the right way, but you may not understand exactly what's going on. So you need more than just your body. You need to take notes. It's very important that you have some kind of a Moleskine-like notebook. I carry it on my own all the time. So this is kind of I think that this is probably the most important instrument in my design career. Because everything I do, I just take notes. And once I'm in a meeting and people are talking, I'm also taking notes. Once I'm on the streets, I take notes looking at people. That's important because I'm all the time basically doing observations of our culture. Smartphone, taking pictures, audio recordings, documents that you can collect and, for example, ask for people, may I have a copy of this, may I have a copy of that. You take some folders, papers, whatever you see in the activity you are studying, For example, if you're studying the nurse work and then the nurse has some papers, you may take a picture with your phone and you may even take a copy of the paperwork she's doing. Inquiry protocols, for example, the activity inquiry guide, those questions that I showed before. This is an instrument you can use to study, collect evidence. And you may have your own topics, your own questions in a semi-structured interview protocol, which is probably written down on your notebook. This is a very big name for something very simple, which is writing down in a piece of paper, what do you want to ask? It is different definitely from questionnaire. You see that I do not put a questionnaire here, survey, because I do believe that surveys are not really good for ethnographic studies. A survey is not good because you do not have the means to check if people are really doing what they are writing down they are doing. And since ethnography is based on observations and not from self-report, which is questionnaire, you cannot qualify questionnaires as ethnographic studies. So questionnaires are useful, but for bigger samples. Once you want to interview a lot, or actually not interview, but research a lot of different people, and you want to see the diversity, and you cannot reach these people directly because they have different geographical places, you might send a survey. But if you really want to study a small sample, like 5, 10, 20 people, it's much better if you just go there directly in person and then talk to the people and see what they are doing. So now I'm going to show you some devices, some documentation formats that you can use to analyze each of those elements of the activity model. Here you can see, if you want to look at the whole activity, like all the elements at the same time, you just replace the labels by your actual data. And that's what you guys are going to do during the next 2 weeks. So pay attention to this. I'm going to give you a task to do something like that. So here you put the subjects, their mothers, nurses, and doctors, and they are transforming the baby health using baby warmings and so on. They aim at having a healthy baby, and they organize themselves into monitoring, evaluating, spiritual support. Some people do both, some people do one of them. And those people, they all form a community of baby care, and they work under a sterile environment, stable temperature, right? It's a very controlled place to avoid infections. Now let's drill down to each element of the activity. So this is activity space. This is something which is not exactly in the model, because I actually made my own thesis on addition to this model, which is the notion of space. But anyhow, you can study activity in the way people move around an office. And you can use the spaghetti diagram, it's kind of funny way, just draw lines. So each person or each professional has a different color here. For example, the account manager is always going from the PMO to the designers to the proof and so on. But this guy is a photographer in production, nobody goes there to production room. But he does go. And here is another different way of mapping space regarding some topics that you predefine before you use this in London to study how people relate to the quality of their environment. And in this small region of London, we ask where are the good places for doing a walk some kind of a shady place with trees, patio from the sun, and where do you have access to health, and all the kind of questions for people to answer in a way that would mean more than just pointing towards a map. We had this kind of symbolic layer over the map to stimulate people to think in a non-geographical way about their space. Once your research is interested on learning about people, you may use personas, which is very well known in design schools. You just create a fictitious
profile of person.
And then you may even have different persons and compare them against age, profession, personality, and so on. These are all made up
from the ethnographic research you have done. These are not real people, but are based on real observations.
Another way of looking at people is through stakeholder mapping. Here you have people related to the project in terms of power and money, influence. And then you see that people are like represented as little creatures, and this guy is really powerful, has a lot of money, has a lot of influence over the project, hence. And here there's a person who is not so much interested, not, doesn't have so much money. And that means if you do stakeholder mapping, you know which persons you need to be have really close to the project and doing a lot of interviews and meetings. If you are researching the object, you might use mind map to understand this object, what are the characteristics, or Play-Doh models. For example, here I was at Citra, the traffic department of our city hall, and I asked the different departments, just make a simple model of what do you do in your department. And they did this thing, like these guys, they were working with drawing the streets, and they made a fashion pedestre, whatever.
Cross street.
What?
Cross street.
Cross street. Cross street? Crossmark.
Crosswalk.
Yeah.
Crosswalk.
Crosswalk.
Crosswalk is what this is. Alright, the crosswalk represents what they do. But they do not only do crosswalks, they do other things, but that's what people have in their minds. And here these guys work with education, they work with connecting people. These guys work with a lot of phone calls, they need a phone. These guys are working with strategies, they need a brain. And I do remember those two groups, and once they put this on the table,
wow, that's what you do? I never understood what you actually do. And that's so strange. In big corporations, it happens a lot. People do not understand what is the object of the other department's activity. And they have a big trouble because the object is what actually gives the results to the org, and this result of one department is brought to another department, and they have to deal with that. And sometimes it's completely unexpected, the result. And if you want to talk about results, you can use those two different models. Value proposition canvas, Matheus knows very well because you probably have used for your PBAP projects, right?
Yeah, we'll do like three of those.
Three of those, right.
You basically try to think about you are creating a product, and this product will have a result on the user experience. So the product will have game creators to increase the game of the user and pain relievers to reduce the pain. And here basically a very simple description of the user activities. So the result of a design or production activity is to devise a product, to produce a product that can be used by a user. And that's what this value proposition canvas is all about. The fishbone diagram is used basically to do kind of a reverse engineering. How do we get this result, which is not good, right? If you have a bad result, you can do fishbone diagram analysis, and here you see why you have poor quality of care. Then you have major causes here, and all the detailed and aggravating characteristics that made this poor quality of care happens. For example, you have policies that have poor or no referral systems, overcrowding in the emergency department. All of this contributes to poor quality of care. You can also use fishbone for devising new results. For example, okay, this is the bad result. What do we need to do to get good results?
You know
Kaizen? I've read a little bit about it.
So a process for
continuous
improvement.
Yeah.
Of anything. So we use fishbone diagrams always at the start. Like we find a problem, and then we identify what is the part of it that has most problems, like the process or the environment, and then we'll tackle those problems because it's obviously the more impacting area.
Right.
So it's very effective.
And do you use to describe what's going on, or do you also
or do you also use for devising new results? For example, what you need to do to change?
We first describe whatever is happening.
Right.
In the fishbowl, we have a problem.
Yeah.
And we find out everything that's associated.
Right.
And describe it. So then we can get like the part is most concentrated, and we like rate it like a level of problem, and then we'll tackle it first.
Right, right, I see. Yeah, this is a method that mostly used by engineers, by service experts, not so much by designers, and also this one. But I like the activity theory framework because it brings all of these guys together. It makes sense using all these methods together. Activity instruments. So these are all the technologies that people use. I like very much the act-on-act diagram. Once you draw people and how they relate, for example, these two stakeholders, they relate by meetings. They never call themselves. They only meet by meetings. And these guys never meet in person. They always call by phone. And these people don't know each other, but they share data through a server. And these people, they do not work together, but they share the same printer. And they meet eventually there. So it's kind of an interesting way of looking at a social network enabled by instruments, technologies. And a very practical way of getting to know what are instruments is to ask people to open your bag and put everything on the table, and then I take a picture. Bag studies, they are called. What's in your bag? By looking at this bag, what is the activity? What is the activity that requires all these instruments? Can you tell?
What?
Bike maintenance. He's a bike maintenance. I don't know. He's a guy who fixes bikes. And then he has all the instruments right away in his bag all the time. The division of labor can be represented by sequential diagram from UML. You know this probably, guys, right? UML, you know? UML? No? Never heard about it? Well, UML. Well, this is a standard language to describe abstract, in an abstract way, software structure. Right? And they have one particular format called Grady-Bunch diagram, also called known as sequential diagram. Then in which you divide the actors in three different lines, or whatever. Each actor is a line, and what happens is that you go on a kind of a timeline basis, you see how do the actors interact. So this actor pays Mercado Pago, then the seller do not send the product as expected, then there's a deadline. Once the money is given back to the buyer, or there is a negotiation to see if the seller can really send it again. And there's also the role of the Mercado Pago mediators guys. They really have to recheck if the buyer have paid correctly. They must retain the money and only give the money to the seller once everything is alright for the negotiation. Have you ever used Mercado Libre? This is their paying system. It's a mediation or payment system which gives a lot of trust on their customers, and that's why they are growing so much. Of course, sometimes things can go wrong with this system, but it's quite much better than just a few demigods. And here you see a different way of, a more like spatial way of looking at division of labor through isometric infographics, and you have a simplified explanation of the process of changing the object. So the object is being transformed here first from the residual waste that people are getting some materials from the residual, then they do something, they put it back, and then they deliver to the trucks. There are different people involved with different tasks, but they are transforming the same object. That's called division of labor. Rules can be described in many ways, mostly just boring documents like rule books, like laws and so on. But I like describing them in a more visual way so you can really understand the impacts of those rules.
here is a basic, a simple workflow diagram, step-by-step flow. Things are happening this way because you need to follow the procedure that way. That's how things work in this company. And here there's a decision diagram showing not the way things go all the time, but the way it should go if you have contingencies. And here you plan, for example, if you have a pupil which is very dark, and then there's a lot too much time for the pupil to dilatate, to expand or to expand, then you might have a physiological problem or sympathetic lesion. Then you should do chemical testing if that's the case. And if the pupil is light, not dark, you might have a really very, very sympathetic lesion.
Can you imagine a pupil which is not dark? This sounds very scary, right? Last but not least, how do you devise activities community? How do you represent it? There are two methods that I'm showing here to you. Community mapping, once you ask, especially children, they are really good on understanding what is the community, what is the core of the community.
Those very simple drawings, they can really show what is the gist of the community. Being close together and the role of the yard, for example, in connecting those houses. And even the cemetery is an important part of this community. Another way is to invite many different people from the community and ask them to do a collage with magazines.
And then they cut and then they made a collage by themselves, representing the major values. And it's kind of their own representation of their community values. All right. My last recommendation, once you start using those tools, is always come back to the big picture and update what you have done before. Otherwise, you might not have a big picture and just be drawn to the details of one aspect of the activity diagram. The main advantage of the activity diagram is actually to keep track of all of these things together. You have a holistic view of the activity, not just looking at the instruments, not just looking at the rules, because that's what other approaches to activity analysis do. For example, if you do Lean, they do a lot of things related to the division of labor. For example, Kaizen also works a lot with rules. Other kind of ethnographies focus a lot on community, on more the subjective or emotional aspect. Some people, especially if you're computer science, they do the requirements gathering, only look at the instruments or the technology. And some people from psychology only look at the people, and they forget about all these things. That's why it's so powerful using this model, because you take it into account different perspectives. There are advanced topics in the activity theory, which I just want to mention now, but you will get into this advanced topic after you get data from the field. You will use. I don't want to introduce too much for you now, but I just want to remind you that object expansion was a topic that we dealt in the last two lectures. So if you don't know what it means, you should go back to the recordings that I'm going to put on the record. Contradiction, connection between multiple activities and participatory ethnography. These are some advanced topics that I don't want to explain now, but we will cover them in the future. All right? So